Hello and welcome to another Network Optimist production of The Networking Fools, with your Networking Fools and hosts, J.W. Najarian and Bob Schechter, as they discuss business, finance, and lifestyle. Hello, everybody. This is J.W. Najarian and Bob Schechter with The Networking Fools. Hello, Bob. How are you doing today?
Hi. Good afternoon, J.W. I'm great. Looking forward to our interview with Spike.
Yeah, it's going to be excellent. It's a beautiful day here in southern sunny California, 80 degrees and no wind. How about yourself? What are you doing out there?
It's hot, humid, typical lovely Florida weather.
I love these shows where you can get somebody in Florida and somebody in California talking. And Spike, I think he's in Sacramento today. So there you go, all around the world. Anyway, today we have, I'm really excited. I know I say that every time I get somebody, but I'm really excited to have Spike Humor on with us today. I've known Spike for a little while. We've become friends over a short period. I've watched Spike at many different seminars, as I used to go watch Jay Abraham, who he worked with for years. And for those of you who don't know Spike Humor, for over 25 years, Spike has been one of the world's leading experts on increasing profits, performance enhancement, and personal growth. He's been called the go-to guy for scores of individuals and business owners around the world who want to pull themselves out of the brink of disaster, or other people who need to propel their businesses to new record highs. He's been a featured speaker at many business seminars and acceleration workshops, and his advice and methods have been proven out time and time again by generating tens of millions of dollars for some of his clients. When Jay Abraham, considered by many to be one of the greatest marketing minds ever, went looking for someone to help drive his and his clients' businesses to greater levels of success, Spike was the guy he turned to. According to Jay, Spike is probably the finest business performance enhancement specialist I've ever met, and an utter master at finding the underperforming leveraging spots that are keeping your business from soaring. So anyway, Spike, great to have you here. Thanks very much for coming in and being on with us today.
Well, I appreciate it, JW and Bob. Thank you both. It's an honor and a privilege to be here.
I want to get right into it. I don't want to make this a long, drawn-out interview, but there's so many questions I have for you. I'm just going to jump right in, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's start with how you got started as an expert in business and personal success.
Well, it's a long story because I'm an old guy, but I've had a personal interest in personal growth and performance, in health acceleration and performance enhancement, really pretty much all my life, in sports and other things that I did. But I got into business kind of the hard way. I mean, I've worked my way up through a bunch of blue collar labor jobs, and eventually I got into manufacturing. And through hard work and a lot of perseverance, or maybe stubbornness or stupidity, eventually I worked my way up into upper management and began running manufacturing companies. But along with that, what happened is that I also had the opportunity to kind of go down a path of not only professional growth, but also personal growth, and found some ways to kind of align not only what businesses were doing, but also what people were looking to achieve through their business. So over time, what happened, I kind of moved into the seminar business, moved in the consulting business, and kind of became known for someone who could help people turn their business around. And I think it was because I was able to see problems, but also to kind of rely on some of the manufacturing background that I had to really understand the process of optimization and innovation, and really being able to look at things and not only see the problems, but also be able to measure the impact of solutions as we started to implement them.
Well, you say you were in manufacturing. What did you actually do? Were you project management?
I did a lot of things over the years. I started off running a machine, and I was just a guy who walked in off the street and just worked pretty doggone hard. And eventually, I became a lead person and a supervisor, then a production manager, and worked in production inventory control for a period of time, so I could do a lot of analysis of data and project a lot of stuff using forecasting models and methodologies. Then eventually, I became a plant manager, and one of my roles became for this organization. We had seven manufacturing plants. I was kind of a troubleshooter, that if one of the manufacturing plants weren't working well, or if they had problems with the labor force, or for some reason there was a disconnect between management and the people who performed the tasks on a daily basis, or something just wasn't up to snuff, they would ask me to go in and try to diagnose the problem, see if I could figure out what the solutions were, and help kind of lead the management and lead the organization in a different direction. And because of that, I really got familiar with how to make quick change and how to really diagnose problems, but also how to communicate with a wide variety of people and take on a lot of different challenges. And then eventually what happened is that the company asked me to head up a project team for a complete process reengineering of the company. It was a very large company. It was about a $700 million company. So through that process, I got to experience and really learn about how you go in and you look at all of the critical strategic steps that go on in a business and look at all the activities that are there, but most importantly, how to evaluate the things that were essential versus the things that were non-essential so that you could really find the high leverage points and focus on those, and you could either eliminate, reduce, delegate, or in some case, obsolete the things that were no longer necessary or needed.
Well, that goes along with what I believe, and that is if you can't measure it, you can't manage it.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I was a student of W. Edwards Deming, and one of the things that he talked about, that you know, that which can be measured can be managed or controlled, and that which can be controlled can be optimized. And if you think about manufacturing, you know, in a lot of cases when you get into quality control and statistical process control and those types of things that kind of came into vogue in the United States in the 1970s and early 80s, it really was about being able to measure what was going on so that you could eliminate the variations and fluctuations that were going on in the business so that you could optimize the process. But along with that, what one of the things that really stood out, candidly, JW, was the fact that because I had a lot of exposure to a lot of different operations and a lot of different businesses, a lot of different people, cultures, and those types of things, I also noticed that there were certain things that were going on in some plants or some businesses that weren't happening in others. So we were able to take a lot of the things, the best practices in some cases, or in some cases things that were totally unique, and kind of innovate the processes and the systems and the cultures across plants, across businesses, and then ultimately when I became a consultant, really across companies and with different business owners.
And I want to get into that a little further, but I'm going to back up just a little bit because I did mention Jay Abraham, and I don't want to mention him just to mention him, but I think I recall from speaking to you that you had a rather interesting story about how you got together with Jay. How did you capture his interest? I mean, how did you meet him and get together with him to the point where you were actually sharing stage with him many times?
Okay.
Still do,
well, yeah, I do. In fact, we still do some speaking together. You know, like a lot of people, I mean, I started off as a fan of Jay and his work with marketing. I mean, he was, you know, one of the top marketing minds, and I think still is, in terms of, you know, how to create a position in a market and how to be able to craft a story and write copy and all those kinds of things that many businesses just don't know how to do, or in many cases just don't do from a marketing standpoint. And I used to get these incredibly long sales letters from Jay that were just masterful. I mean, they were almost like reading stimulating novels. You know, so he was always someone that I had aspired to meet and at some point in time engage. And I had known about Jay for probably 10 years before I actually met him. But one of the things that I wanted to do was not only to get to know Jay, but also I wanted to get access to all of his content and all of his materials. And fortunately, what happened is that I found something that Jay was looking for, and I happened to have access to it because I was doing some consulting work with a small public company, and I knew that Jay was looking to get involved with companies on a performance basis. So I called Jay up one day, and at the time, you know, Jay was kind of notorious for being very, very difficult to reach. And I called and talked to Jay's assistant and said I was calling to speak to Jay. And of course, you know, she was kind of putting me through the ring. And I told her, you know, well, I have this opportunity for Jay. Explained exactly what it was. And within 5 minutes, I had him on the phone. I was in his office the next day. Ended up doing a deal with Jay for his entire library of every product and every program that he had ever done. And ended up bringing him on as a business consultant on a performance basis for a company that I was working with. So I went from being a distant fan to being a close colleague in a matter of 24 hours, and then he and I worked together on a number of projects, and then we became friends and colleagues. And when Jay was looking for someone to come in for his business, he asked me if I would come in and do some consulting work for him. And then from there, we kind of realized that we had some complementary skill sets and some skill sets that would help maybe fill in the gap for some of his program participants and also kind of enhance some of the things that, that he was doing from a strategy standpoint.
There's a really interesting lesson to learn here, and that is about when a lot of people call people and they're all about what the person can do for them or here's my product, here's my service, and it looks like you did a little homework and you knew what Jay wanted and you delivered that up.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point, GW. I mean, one of the things that I share with my clients and I share with people with my programs is that, you know, I think the biggest mistake that that most people make is that, you know, it comes down to the fact that sometimes, you know, they're knocking on a door and sometimes it's not even the right door. But also, what, you know, if they're knocking on the door and they're lucky enough to get someone to open the door, and if they're standing there with their hand out, chances are people are going to close that door pretty quickly. So I think the key is, number one, you know, you have to understand who it is that you're trying to reach. Number two, you have to understand what's important to them. And number three, if you can figure out a way that you can provide value for someone in advance or at the very least simultaneously, it's much easier to ask once you've given. And I think, you know, a lot of people make the mistake that, you know, they call up, you know, someone, whether it be someone in the marketplace or someone of stature or significance in an industry, and they say, well, you know, will you do this for me? Will you do this for me? Will you do this for me? And while it's great that, you know, that people have a strong understanding of what it is that they need, but the bottom line is, if you're not looking to offer something in return, if you're not looking for a way to create value in exchange for what it is that you're asking for, essentially what you're doing is begging.
Okay, let's get back to what you do, because Jay is, he's a great marketer. We talk about Jay as the, you know, he's the copy guy, the marketing guy, but what you do as a turnaround specialist is much more comprehensive, and I want to get into that a little bit, but let's start with, what is a turnaround specialist?
Well, in the traditional sense, JW, it's really someone who goes into a business when a business is on the brink of disaster and you know, tries to either resurrect it from the, you know, or tries to put out the fires or resurrect it from the ashes, which is not so much what I do anymore. What I do is that I consider a turnaround in a little bit different context. Because I think what happens is that most businesses, when they get into trouble, it's because they've waited too long to address the situation, or they didn't have the right processes or systems in place in order to be able to measure their performance, or something unexpected or unanticipated came into their business and they weren't flexible enough or agile enough to deal with it. But one of the things that I recognized about 7 or 8 years ago, that rather than having to be the person that got called in the middle of the night because a company couldn't make payroll or they had problems with their creditors or something else, is that I really could take that whole concept of taking a turnaround technology, and I created some proprietary processes that I use, but taking that turnaround technology and go to someone and say, okay, rather than waiting until you're forced to change by market conditions or the economy or something inside your business, why don't we take those same strategies, those same evaluation processes, those same techniques, and put it into a model and put it into a system so that you can actually determine when you want to change, how you want to change, where you want to change, and the reasons why you want to change. And it really transformed not only a lot of the people that I've worked with in terms of their business and in many cases even their lives, it also transformed me in terms of my career and some of the things that I really enjoyed doing.
Right. Well, we only want the top 10 of your proprietary secrets. So.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Bob.
I know that you... Obviously, I know you don't like to make these things into infomercials, and we don't either. But you took all that knowledge, and I know you absolutely hate the term guru, but in my mind, somebody that can both recognize and understand a problem before it becomes a problem, that to me is a guru. That's separating you from the people who just talk about it. You've learned to recognize things, and you did a program, which I'm not sure if you still are selling it, but it was called the 10-Day Turnaround. Is this still a viable product? Are you still using it?
It is. In fact, I still use it. I use a lot of the materials, a lot of the informations, a lot of the information that was in that program, and I've actually updated it and enhanced it and expanded it into a broader program called the Level Up Business Acceleration System, because it wasn't just about turning things around. It was also that once you had it turned around, once you had it pointed in the direction that you wanted, what was it that you could do on an ongoing basis that would sustain your growth, but also accelerate your performance. So I was able to take a lot of the things that I did in the 10-day turnaround and actually expand those and build those out and kind of take it through a longer-term process.
Let's make it clear to our listeners today about the 10-day turnaround, because I'd asked you this question before. Oh, you can turn around a company in 10 days. And I think you explained it to me like, no, there's a process. I think you called it Asia, that you go through that takes about 10 days to figure out where a company's at and all those things. Can you talk about that?
Sure, absolutely. In fact, what would happen, JW and Bob, you know, is that most of the time when I would go to work with a prospective client, or I would do an evaluation with a business, generally, I mean, it was pretty urgent. I mean, there was something that was really going on in that business that had to be addressed very, very quickly. And it wasn't just about recognizing the problem. I mean, in many cases, the business owner or the organization, I mean, they were acutely aware of what the problem was. But generally what would happen is that I'd have about a two-week period of time really to kind of get a handle on something and figure out what it is that we were going to do, put together some recommendations, and start to take some actions. So what I did is that I developed a four-stage process that really took 10 days. And we could do it in 2 weeks, and we could do it in-depth, and we could do it very detailed, and we could do it very responsibly, very effectively, and very strategically. And it really was this. It came out to a four-stage process called Asia, A-S-I-A, and obviously it's not the continent. But the first A in Asia stood for the assessment. We'd go in and get a handle on where the business was, where they wanted to go, what gaps existed between where they were and where they wanted to be, but also what resources were necessary to bridge those gaps, and what resources they had, and what resources we had to go out and source, or we had to find, or we had to buy, or we had to acquire in some form or fashion. And then from that, once we knew, you know, exactly where the business was and where they wanted to go, we would get into the S of Asia, which was strategy. We would formulate a strategy or strategies that would start to bridge those gaps. Now, we had a plan, and we had a pretty good understanding, but most importantly, what we needed to do was start taking action, and we needed to take that action pretty quickly. So we got into the I of Asia, which is the implementation of the tactics and the actions and the decisions and such that would really make that business start to move from where it was to where it wanted to go. Now, the final A in Asia is probably the most important, and it's where most businesses get off track, and candidly, it's where most people in life get off track, and that is they don't make the adjustments that are necessary to keep themselves on track once they get on track. So what we would do is that we would set up a system that we would measure success, we would measure our movement, we would measure our performance, and we would make the adjustments that were necessary along the way, because quite candidly, no matter how good you are at planning, no matter how good you are at strategy setting, or even in taking actions, things don't always go according to plan. You don't always get the result that you expect by the actions that you take or the decisions that you make. So it's important that when you go through that process that you have a form and you have a system that allows you to make the adjustments along the way. I mean, if you were to think about a rocket, you know, and this is an analogy that, you know, that I'm sure people have heard before, but, you know, think about a rocket that's from a trajectory standpoint, is just off by a half an inch. And it's pointed towards the moon. Well, the further it goes, the greater that gap, the further off course that it goes. And eventually, if you go far enough into space, you know, you literally can miss your target by millions and millions of miles. However, if you were able to make that small adjustment, that micro adjustment along the way, because you were measuring exactly where you were going and exactly what you were getting from a results standpoint, you can make those micro adjustments that would allow you not only to get on course, but to stay on course as you went.
Now, here's a question for you, because Bob and I talk about this all the time, and that is, you know, I have a project management, change management background, and Bob, as a developer, you know, he lives and dies by the NAT chart and PERT charts and all that good stuff. But there's a certain part of us that believes that, you know, shooting from the hip is a skill that you also need. So what do you say about that? Are you really against, you know, shooting from the hip?
No, I'm not.
Do you think everything needs to be laid out?
No, I don't. You know, I think, you know, sometimes people go too far the other way, JW, and that is, you know, I think sometimes people overplan. And, you know, it's back in the days when I used to do sales training, you know, it was difficult to get people to actually start trying to set appointments or actually go out and start doing selling presentations. So they would come into the office and they would get their leads ready and they would line their phone book up and they would get their coffee ready and they'd organize their desk and they'd sharpen their pencils and all those kinds of things. And I had a saying that when I would go in, the filing cabinet goes in the corner, the phone's in front, pick it up, start dialing. You know, and it really comes down to sometimes you just have to jump in and take action. The important thing is that even if you're shooting from the hip, you know, there's certain experiences that we have, there's certain gut feelings that we have, there's certain intuitions that will kind of guide our judgment in terms of the actions that we take. So there's certainly nothing wrong with making well-reasoned decisions and taking well-reasoned action. The key is to make sure that where it's practical and where it's pragmatic to make a plan, you're going to be much more effective at not only understanding what it is that you're trying to accomplish, but also exactly what it is that you're doing. Because what that allows you to do is not only to measure your performance against the target, but it also allows you to replicate those actions or replicate those results over time. And if you don't have a plan where you really can kind of measure the steps and the dates and the activities and the resources, it makes it very, very difficult to manage. Now, that's not to say that you have to sit down and have a perfect plan before you jump into action, but at the same time, if you were going to try to jump across a canyon, and you knew what the distance was, you wouldn't just jump off there and figure, okay, well, I'll just keep jumping until I make it. What you would do is you'd figure out how far you had to jump, and you'd figure out how far you could jump, and before you would actually try to jump across the canyon.
Right. Listen, I used to be hired to take small businesses and make them large businesses. When a business that was growing very fast from 200 to 400 workers and moving up to 2,200, I'd go in and help put the systems together in place to help them, go from a ma-pa company into a larger company and make the transition easier. And I always found that it was easier, even when you're small, to act like a big company because you scale into the big company easily. If you're a large company at 2,200 people and you're still trying to run it like a ma-pa, that's really, really tough. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. And you can agree or not agree with that. I'd love to hear on that. But the question is this. You've been working with medium, large-sized companies. How does what you do scale down to the entrepreneur and the ma-pa, the guy who, home office, works by himself, doesn't have a staff? How does what you do scale to him?
Well, yeah, and it's a great question. I'll say in a variety of ways. I mean, one of the advantages, and there's certainly advantages and disadvantages in any size business, but one of the advantages of large corporations is that, they generally have a lot of resources, they have a lot of infrastructure, they have a lot of people, they have a lot of systems, and they have a big margin of error, right? Because, even if they miss it, they generally have, relatively deep pockets or assets they can borrow against to kind of, course correct as they need. And they also have access to almost, infinite amounts of knowledge and information and skills and expertise. If they don't have it internally, they can go out and they can hire a high-paid consultant. But also they have structures that keep people accountable in many cases, and there's certain disciplines that are instilled in large corporations, meaning that you have to show up for work or you get fired. And what happens, I think, for small businesses in many cases, they're great at certain things. They're great, if they're a doctor or a dentist or they own a health spa or something like that, they're probably really, really good at what it is that they do. But in many cases, they may not be as skilled in marketing or selling or managing or recruiting or some of the other things that are necessary to kind of scale a business. So what happens is that, generally a small business will only grow to the size and level to where it reaches a constraint in the capabilities of the business owner. So if the business owner is great at performing a service or making a product, but they're not great at selling or they're not great at customer service or they're not great at accounting, what happens is that business will stall, it will stagnate, it will get stuck, or it's stymied. And in some cases, it starts to digress. But until and unless that business owner identifies what that limitation is in their business, and either goes out and gets trained in it, or they supplement it by hiring someone, or they bring in a consultant, or they do something to address that constraint, that business will never grow. And if it does grow, it won't continue to grow. Eventually, it'll collapse under its own weight. So one of the things that I think is absolutely vital for a small business owner is, number one, know exactly what it is that you're really, really great at. Number two, figure out what it is that you're not so good at, but also what keeps you away from doing the thing that you do best in your business, and figure out a way to supplement that or outsource it or eliminate it or reduce it at the very least so that you can focus more of your time on the things you do best and the things that ideally are going to have the biggest strategic impact on your business. And then finally, making sure that you have some form of accountability. It could be someone in your business. It could be your spouse. It could be a friend. It could be a mastermind group. It could be a mentor. It could be a consultant. It could be someone that not only helps you get on track, but ensures that you stay on track because you have accountability, you have discipline, and you have a focus that in many cases it's hard for an entrepreneur or a small business owner to maintain on their own.
Okay, let's back up a little bit because it sounds so easy to say, okay, if you're not really good at this skill or that skill, delegate it, get it out. Many of the people I know that work in these small businesses are working on no budget. Do you have some ways that a guy can go out there and get people to work for them or utilize other people's talents?
Yeah, well, there's a variety of ways, and I'll give you one of those in just a moment, JW. But one of the things that I just want to share is an obvious tip, But I can tell you that most people that I know, when they hear it, they say, oh, that makes great sense. But most people that I know don't do this. You know, the very first thing to do, is to sit down and kind of evaluate everything you're doing in your business. Because most business owners, and I think most people, come up with to-do lists, right? They say, okay, I got to do this, got to do this, got to do this, got to do this, got to do this. Well, there's two things that need to be done there. Number one, evaluate what it is that's most important, what it is most significant, what it is that you think is going to have the greatest or most immediate impact on your business, and make sure you're focused on those things, you know, strategic priorities. The second thing is, and this is something that almost no one does, and that is to come up with a don't list. Okay, and I'll give you a small example. I was talking with a client a couple of weeks ago, and one of the things that I had them do was to keep an activity journal for a week of everything that they did. Okay, the first thing that they did every single morning is they got on their computer and they opened up their emails and started seeing everything that came in overnight, and they would spend the first 4 hours of the day going through their emails, whether they were important, whether they were strategic, whether they were significant, whether they had anything to do with the damn business or not. That was the first thing that they did every day. So the very first thing that we did, we said, okay, here's one of the things you're not going to do, and that is you're not going to look at your emails until 11:30 in the morning so that you can get your strategic priorities, the most significant activities, and the things that you define that are most important in your business done first. And if you do those things first, anything else that you do beyond that will be a bonus. But unless you can do those strategic things, you're not going to get the results that you want. Now, in terms of how can you get other people to do things with you if you don't have a budget? Well, one of the easiest ways to do is exchange value for value. There may be certain things that you do and you do very, very well. Perhaps you're a brilliant marketer. Perhaps you're great at copywriting. Perhaps you're really, really good at customer service. And one of the things that you could do is perhaps trade some of your customer service skill or some of your copywriting skill in exchange for someone's accounting skill. You know, so if there's an opportunity to do something on a reciprocal basis. In some cases, what you can do is that you can find someone who's an expert or someone who's very good at doing something that needs to be done in your business that you know that if it was done, would generate more revenue, would generate more profit, or would save some money in your business, or allow you to grow your business in other ways. And one of the things that you could do is bring someone in and get them to help you or to assist you with that skill set in exchange for a percentage of the proceeds or a percentage of the cost savings or a percentage of the profits or the revenues. So there's lots of ways to do that. You can also team up by finding somebody who has excess capacity or someone who's got skills in their organization that are being under leveraged or underutilized, and see if there's a way that you can get those people to allocate some of those sunken costs or some of those resources into an activity that you have, and that you pay them on receivables. You know, so for instance, if you know that the work is being done today and you're going to bill for 30 days from now, you know that you're going to assign some of those receivables or you're going to assign some of those incoming funds as a result of having that increase in sales or that increase in revenue, and have some of that money actually be assigned to someone so that it's not strictly on performance, it's not necessarily on spec, it's basically an agreement that you're going to pay them, but you're going to pay them within 45 days or you're going to pay them in 60 days or whatever period of time you think your receivables are going to come in.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I don't want to play devil's advocate, but one of the problems I see with a lot of small businesses is the control by the owner. Mm-hmm. What do you call it? The management, where he won't let anybody touch anything. What do you call that?
Micromanagement.
Yeah, micromanaging. Yep. People micromanage all the time, and it causes their businesses not to grow. How do you deal with that?
Well, you know, there's a variety of ways. One is, the first thing that I try to do is challenge people's beliefs, their assumptions, and the stories that they tell themselves. And it doesn't matter whether it's personal growth or business growth. I mean, you know, we all have beliefs, we all have assumptions, and we all have certain stories that we tell ourselves about what's possible and what we're good at, what needs to be done, and kind of the reality that we create in our head. And what happens in many cases, a business owner will say to themselves, you know what, I'm the only one who can do it. Well, first of all, that's not true. You're not the only one who can do it. Maybe the only one in your organization who can do it, or you may be the only one who can do it well, or you may be the only one who can do it the way you want it, or you may be the only one who can do it the best, but you're not necessarily the only one who can do it. So the first thing you do is start challenging some of those beliefs. But instead of getting into the point of, you know, arguing micromanagement on a micro level, I try to take it to a macro level, and I say, okay, you know what? Absolutely, positively, you want to have control, but really what you want is results. And if you try to maintain the same level of control, you're not going to get the level of results that you want. So what's more important to you? You know, having control over everything on a small level or having results on a larger level that will allow you to have the resources, that will allow you to grow your business. But really what it comes down to, JW and Bobby, it really comes down to a question of control, and that question of control comes from the fact that They're concerned with having a lack of clarity or having a lack of certainty or having a lack of confidence in the things that are going on around them because they don't have a way to measure and monitor the activities and the results that come from those activities of other people. They don't have a way to hold people accountable. They don't have a way to set clear expectations. They don't have a way to manage the tests and the results in such a way that people can go out and be effective on their own. And the bottom line is, I mean, this is the reality, though, is some people just cannot escape that because they would rather be in control than they would be in having a larger business. I mean, it's like, you know, the old adage, you know, would you rather be right or would you rather be happy? You know, you can argue all day long, you know, until you prove that you're right, but if it's not making you happy, then it's probably not the right thing to do. So the question is, you know, having absolute and total control and doing everything yourself, does that give you the results you want? If the answer is yes, keep doing it. If the answer is no, then open your mind and consider some other possibilities.
Yeah, I learned that with my wife. I now say, happy wife, happy life.
There you go, buddy.
Well, I was going to ask, you know, what's the top couple of things that businesses do right and a couple of things they do wrong, but it looks like you've kind of gone over that. Is there anything that just pops up to mind that you haven't mentioned?
Well, you know, I would say, you know, and this is something I think is increasingly and incredibly important for businesses, and I still see more businesses than not overlooking this. You know, something dramatic has happened in the last 20 years, and obviously this isn't something that people don't recognize. But, you know, the way we market, the way we communicate, the way we're perceived, and the way people buy has dramatically changed. The internet has revolutionized everything. I mean, you know, Chris Anderson talks about it in Long Tail that it used to be that you could get one product in front of a couple of million people by using broadcast advertising, but now a million products can be put in front of one person with a single search. And the challenge that most people have is that they're being faced with increasing commoditization and increased buying pressure in terms of pricing from the market. And what happens is that most people try to compete more on price. So what they do is, if only I could sell it cheaper, if only I could sell it for less. And that's a formula for failure. I mean, the bottom line is Walmart's going to eat your lunch every single day. And eventually, you know, their pockets are deeper and they're going to put you out of business. And if it's not Walmart, it's going to be somebody else. But also people who shop simply on price are the people that beat you up the most, appreciate you the least, and really have the least amount of loyalty, because if they can get a better price somewhere else, they're going to leave you. But really the key, and I think this is one of the points of strategic leverage for most businesses, is that if you can really define what it is that you do in a unique way. Now, everyone's familiar with the term, or most people, I think, are familiar with the term unique selling proposition. It was coined by Russell Reeves in the 1950s, and it really had to do with a slogan of how you can convey to the marketplace something catchy that was memorable so that people would understand what you do. But a number of years ago, I started working on a thing, and I teach it today, and that is, how do you create a unique value proposition? Because it's not just about what you sell. It's about the value that you create, but also the value that people perceive. And let me give you an example. If you were to draw a bell-shaped curve, and it doesn't have to be a bell-shaped curve, it's easy to describe, and you were to draw a line right down the middle, and on the far left side of that, you had cost, okay? And in the middle of the line is price. Now, so if you're a business owner, you understand the difference between cost and price is considered profit, right? $2 worth of profit. What most people don't realize is that the other part of the equation is that if you go to the far right-hand corner and you put value out there, the difference between price and perceived value is the profit of the customer, the profit of the client, the profit of the marketplace. And the better you can convey that value, the better you can articulate that value, the more clearly you can get them to understand that, and not only understand it, but also to appreciate it and do it in such a way that they see you as being unique. If you can create a deeper value proposition, if you can enhance the perceived value in the marketplace, your clients and customers see that the fact that what they're profiting, what they're realizing in terms of value goes way up. So now all of a sudden, instead of becoming a commodity, you become a unique experience. You become a unique provider of your product or service, and you're not competing with people on the same level. Now, how do you do that? Well, one of the things you have to understand is that, what is it that you do that's different than most people in your industry? What is it that you do really, really well? What is it that you do from a combination of experience or interaction standpoint that people can expect from you and your company on a consistent basis? And how can you articulate that in such a way that people see that as a benefit or a solution to a problem that they're having, and articulate it in such a way that they understand that what you're giving them really is something broader, really is something bigger than what it is that they may be perceiving on their own?
That's a difficult concept, though. I mean, the internet poster child for value and value propositions is Zappos.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're a shoe store. You can get the same product that they have less in several places, but their entire marketing campaign was phenomenal. It's a pleasure to shop there. So people do shop there, and they're very successful. But the story behind it, though, is that for every Zappos that's out there, at the time when I saw the article, they said there were somewhere like 300,000 failures for every one Zappos that's success. And, of course, as the years progress and the Internet becomes more and more, you know, it's prolific and everybody's on there with 20 sites instead of just their one site, those numbers are going to go up. So there's a point at which fear and finances are definitely going to trump logic and all of this learning that we're going through. So I'm not sure that people will ever appreciate the value of organics because they're so bent on making today's living. In fact, I think what was that Tony Robbins always said, people are too busy making a living to and forgetting how to live or something.
Bob, but to go over that point a little bit, you know, just like Dell and Gateway and Zappos and some others, some of these companies did exactly what Spike was saying, and that is they told you what their unique value was. And with Dell, the reason they beat Gateway was because they had better customer service.
Yeah, I can share with you, a couple things, and it's a great point, Bob, and I appreciate you bringing it up. I mean, first and foremost, if you go to Zappos, and I've spent some time with Dr. David Vick and Tony Hsieh, and I don't know them well, but I've met them both and spent some time with them. But if you ask the people at Zappos, they will tell you they're not in the shoe business. They're in the business of creating a delightful customer experience. Now, that's great to say, but the bottom line is you can't eat that, and Zappos lost money for about 9 years before they became the retailer that they are. But there are a couple things that you can do, I think, as a business owner that will get you closer to that path. Now, not everything works for every business, and I'm not an evangelist for one true way in anything. But first and foremost, you ask yourself the question, what business are you in? Now, most people will say whatever the product or the service is, and that's not the business that you're in. That's what you provide. With the business that you're in is the solutions that you provide to your marketplace or the benefits that you offer to your marketplace. And what happens is that if you're able to articulate what that benefit is in dollars and cents or at the very least on a subjective value standpoint, people understand that if I put a dollar in, I get $10 worth of experience. I mean, if you think about it, you know, when someone goes, to Disneyland, you know, they're not doing that for a profit. They're doing it for an experience. And Disneyland understands very well that what they're providing is not an amusement park. They're providing a fantasy experience for children and a way for families to bond. And by thinking about what business that you're really in, what is it that you truly provide in terms of benefits and solutions to the marketplace, and how you can articulate, ideally quantify, but at the very least qualify what it means to the life of your client or the life of your prospect, it will allow you to position yourself differently in their minds, but also in their hearts. And it's not an easy thing to do. I'm not saying that it's something that happens overnight, but it's a question that needs to be asked. It's a question that needs to be answered over time, and it's a question that needs to be reexamined on an ongoing basis, unless you're a convenience store or something like that, because in many cases it's just simply a price. It's a commodity. It's a commoditized industry, and you simply compete on price or location.
Well, we talk about this all the time, Bob, and that is, the free line that everybody throws out, and we're getting tired of it. Everything's free on the Internet. The expectation is that everything should be free. And we're coming to the conclusion that people value things based on the value you put on it. So if you say that gold bars that you're selling are going to be free, people will never start paying for them. They'll always expect them to be free from you.
Right, but you do have to at some point go beyond that perception and actually be able to present them with value. But
I need to ask
another question because I don't want to lose track of the time. Yep. This is not our first time we've spoken, and the program that you have spoken about, this Asia assessment, strategies, implementation, and adjustment, you say that you've actually not so much abandoned it, but transcended it, and you're now going to this level up program, which is a rapid business acceleration system. How is this different? Because I've been able to take that Asia strategy and relate it to just about everything. I mean, it's a great acronym, and it relates to just about every time I've seen a business failing. I always am able to go back and say, well, look, if they would have just done this, it would have worked. And now you're saying you've gone beyond that. What's the next step?
Well, you know, and thank you, Bob. I mean, it's a great question. I mean, you know, first and foremost, let me clarify my statement a little bit. You know, I haven't abandoned the 10-day turnaround technologies or any of those types of things. In fact, I still do programs with that and still have products, and they're great products. But if you were to think about the Level Up program, you know, the 10-day turnaround basically allows you to get a very clear picture on what it is that you need to do, allows you to start to put some strategies in play and implement some of the tactics and make the adjustments along the way, and it allows you to get your business moving if you're stuck, or in some cases if your business just isn't giving you the results that you want. It allows you to really examine it with fresh eyes and allow you to formulate new strategies and allows you to take new actions and make sure that you're moving forward. But at the same time, there are other things that businesses need other than just transformation. There's other things that businesses need other than just the turnaround or a plan for change. You know, they need the ability to be able to craft and articulate a unique value proposition. They need to be able to identify exactly who it is that they're trying to communicate with and figure out the best methods or methodologies to reach those people. In many cases, they need to understand, you know, some of the other tools and some of the other things that they could be employing to engage resources like barter or joint ventures or strategic alliances. So the Level Up Business Acceleration Program isn't just about getting your business moving. It's about speeding it up and allowing it to grow at whatever rate and pace that you choose, but also providing you additional resources and additional strategies and tactics and bits of information that will sustain your success over time. And literally, I mean, to me, you know, if I'm a business owner, you know, one of the greatest things that I think you can understand and embrace is that change is not a one-time occurrence. You know, it's something that happens on a continual basis. And if you make a change today, the change that you make today may be effective for 6 months, it may be effective for a year, but it may not be effective forever. So while you can use the things like Asia and you can use a lot of the things that are in the 10-day turnaround process to get your business moving, the Level Up Business Acceleration Program is really designed to support your business over a longer period of time.
That makes sense. And in fact, that was one of the problems I had when looking at the original program was, and I've given you the analogy, it's like going and taking golf lessons. I can take off two strokes after taking my lessons, but then I'm out there, and if I want to take my game to the next level or to the professional level, I need that ongoing mentoring, that ongoing coaching. I need somebody that's going to keep reassessing what I'm doing or help me or give me a program that will allow me to keep reassessing and stay on that same track of acceleration, if you will. And I assume that's what this Level Up is all about then.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, and you know, just as an example, and to continue the analogy of it, you know, and you know, Bob, I mean, and you're a golfer and I'm not, so this may not completely ring true. So please correct me if I'm wrong. But you know, everyone in almost every game, you know, has certain strengths and certain weaknesses. And what happens is that in most cases, you know, you work with a coach and they help you try to overcome some of your weaknesses or correct some of your flaws. But what happens is that as soon as you correct that flaw, there's another constraint in your game, and that is you may not be as good as something else. You might have taken away your primary weakness, but at the same time, there's something now that you're not quite as good at that wasn't your primary weakness before. And if you just continue to work on the things that are your weaknesses, you know, certainly you can get better. But also one of the things that with the Level Up program, we work on helping you identify your strengths as well, and how can you maximize those things, and how can you get the most return on investment, most return on relationship, most return on effort, by making sure that you're capitalizing on your strengths as well. And the only way you can do that is really to identify those things and to make sure that you're applying your time, applying your effort, applying your resources to the things that are going to get you closer to where you want to be and keep you on track as you go.
And does it allow you, does it help you recognize the roadblocks and to extend the analogy, every time I go out to play, I end up breaking a club or two. So I always run into these self-imposed walls.
Yep.
And in business, I'm not quite that bad, but I do have that frustration level in business.
Sure.
Where things are just not going well enough or fast enough. And
yep.
While I'm not the type that ever quits, I do have that ebb and flow, that constant up, and JW will absolutely attest to the fact that I do. I have my, you know, my good days and my bad days, and what I can always use is a coach in business, and I'm lucky enough to have JW there to call me an idiot when the time is right. So is that something else that you're able to do with people, is to get them back in a place where they need to be?
And, you know, here's I have good days, bad days, and there's times where I do better in my business and not quite as well. And, you know, so we, and I, and personally, I mean, I have an accountability partner, who that, you know, will kick me in the butt when I need it and slap me upside the head if I won't, you know, if I want, and put their arm around me when I do what I say I'm going to do. But here's, I think, one of the biggest challenges that small business owners and entrepreneurs, and especially people who are really, really small businesses, face. I mean, we all face it as human beings, but I think in business, is that we all suffer from a lack of clarity, which gives us a sense of uncertainty, and that uncertainty causes hesitation. So, for instance, I'll give you an example. If we're walking down a path, and we're, you know, on a pretty good path, and we're pretty happy with it, and all of a sudden we come up to a giant boulder. Now, we have a couple of choices. Now, we know we're on the path, and we think we know why we want to be there, and we're pretty sure it's the right path, but we're not absolutely certain. Now, the only way we can be certain is if we can get around that obstacle. Now, what happens, you know, we can either go around the obstacle, go over the obstacle, we can stop and stay where we are, or we can go back to where we started and see if there's another way to get where we're going. What happens with most people, when they get to that obstacle, they become paralyzed. But if only they could get around that obstacle and they could see just that path goes a little bit further, they would continue down that path of progress and continue on until they run into another obstacle. So part of the key, part of the essential element, is making sure that you have a sense of clarity about where you are and where you want to go, so that when you see that, when you encounter obstacles, that you can figure out, is this an obstacle that you want to overcome? Is it an obstacle that you want to completely avoid? Or is there another way that if you knew that you got on the other side of it, that it's going to get you to where you want to go? So part of what it is about making sure that as you learn something and you go out and you apply something, you know, the best plan, you know, is only a plan until you start getting a result from it. But being able to evaluate that and say, you know, did I get the result that I wanted? Okay, great. I didn't. I can either do something else. I can keep doing the same thing, or I can do it harder, faster, longer, or do it with someone else. But eventually, you know, if I continue on, I get a greater sense of clarity, I get a greater sense of confidence, and I get a greater sense of certainty, because I can see exactly what it is that I'm getting out of my business and the return that I'm getting on the efforts that I have. But it really comes down to a lack of clarity for most businesses.
Is that where most people fail? I mean, I've heard that most people who fail go like 80% of the way, and just when they're getting to the point where they're going to succeed, they quit.
They really do, because what happens is that they start to lose that sense of clarity, which leads to a sense of, you know, a lack of confidence, which in many cases leads to a lack of action. But if only they knew, if they only knew, JW and Bob, that they only had 20% further to go, people would continue on. But it's when they can't see that they only have 20% further to go, or they they don't have a resource that they can rely on, or they don't have a way to break down what seems to be an insurmountable obstacle into manageable tasks, manageable activities. And, so it really is about, you know, figuring out a way that you can see that you are 80% of the way as opposed to 8% of the way, and that you really are on the right path, and it's just an obstacle in your way that's holding you back to getting to where you want to go, and you just need to find a way to break through that obstacle, which will allow you to continue on the right path. But bottom line is, most businesses don't take the time to think about what it is they're really truly trying to accomplish. They haven't formulated a solid strategy of how they're going to get there. They haven't aligned the tactics and the actions and the activities that they need to undergo, and they really don't have a way to measure the success, because they either don't track their success, or they're not clear about what it is they're trying to accomplish, so they can't make the adjustments when obstacles come up, whether they want to or not.
Okay, let's look at the other side of that coin.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of us have seen Shark Tank, and you get these
mm-hmm.
guys
yep.
on there that have put their houses up for sale to
sure.
to pay for their invention, and
yep.
the guys go up there and say, this is an invention that just can't make it.
Yep.
How do you know when to hold them and when to fold them?
Well, it's a great question, and I don't know that I can give you a global answer, but I'll give you a couple of things that I use. And this is one of the first questions that I ask when I work with a client personally, and that is, you know, does your business and the results that you get from your business give you a return that's equal to or greater to, the investment that you're putting in terms of time, energy, and money? And if the answer is yes, great. You know, how can we maximize that? If the answer is no, we have a couple of choices. You know, how can we change it? Or is it something that really truly has viability? And there are certain indicators. I mean, one is, you know, does a market really exist for what it is that you're offering? Number two, do you have a way to cost effectively reach that market? Can you capture their attention? Can you capture their interest? Can you earn their trust? And ultimately, you know, will someone have a willingness or the ability to even pay for what it is that you want? You know, a friend of mine has a great analogy, and he calls it squirrel clothes. You know, people come up with an idea and saying, you know what, I like squirrel clothes. I like clothes that are made out of squirrels, or I like clothes that I can put on squirrels, and I think it's a great idea. Well, the problem is, unless someone's willing to pay money for that, it doesn't matter how much you like it, doesn't matter how much you love it, bottom line is you're going to starve in business. So the very first thing you have to do is make sure that there's a viable market there that you can reach and that you can touch and that you have a product and a service that they're going to value and benefit by and ultimately be willing to give you money for. And then it really comes down from there, you know, can you manage a business in such a way that allows you to control your costs, that allows you to leverage your strengths, minimize your weaknesses, and allows you to have the structures and disciplines that are necessary to make sure you do it on a consistent basis.
Well, that's great. That's listen, Spike, you've given us so much great information. I want to take a moment to let people know how they can get a hold of you and what you have currently that they can go take a look at.
All right. Well, thank you, guys. The best and easiest way to find out a little bit more about what I do is just go to my website, which is www.spikehumor.com. That's one word, no space, no dot, spikehumor.com. And on there you'll see that there's some free resources in terms of some reports, and there's also information about the Level Up Business Acceleration Program, where you can pop your name in there, and there'll be some videos that'll tell you a little bit about what it is and how it can benefit you and what to do, and we'll actually share some additional tips and some additional strategies as part of that process for you.
That's great. And the Level Up Program, that's coming up really soon, I understand. Is that the same site?
Yep. In fact, the best way to get access to that is to actually go right to my personal site, and that'll put you right into the marketing sequence, where you'll see some videos that'll tell you all about the Level Up Program.
Great. And do you have any speaking? I know you speak a lot. Coming up? I know you speak in Asia a lot. Do you have anything coming up here?
Yeah, in fact, I'll be speaking in Las Vegas the last weekend in January at the Ultimate Joint Venture Boot Camp with a guy named Scott Letourneau. I'll be the keynote speaker over there. I'll be speaking in Japan at the end of February. I'll be in Thailand doing a Entrepreneur's Business School event with a business partner of mine the first week of May. And then after that, programs really throughout the world for the rest of the year.
Oh, that's great. Just to sum it all up, you're a turnaround specialist that actually talks a lot about business and methodologies and models and strategies, but you also do personal growth and development. Is that part of the Level Up and things, or is that a separate program?
No, you know, it's really both, candidly. I mean, you know, one of the things if I were to distinguish myself from, you know, from many of the business consultants that are out there, you know, it would be this. You know, I have a strong belief, and a core philosophy that, you can't really work on a business. What you do is that you work with people. And to the greater degree that you can understand what it is someone's trying to accomplish through their business and the values that they have about their business, the easier it is for you to transform that business. But at the same time, even if you're working with someone on a personal growth level, unless you take into account the things that they use to express their passions and the things that they use to feed their family and pay their bills, you know, you can't really help that person create the results that they want in their life either. So to me, you know, there's certainly a blend between personal growth and business growth, or business performance and personal performance. And depending on the program, you know, there's more business and less personal growth, and vice versa. So I also have a program that'll be coming up here later in the summer in the United States, based on the technology that a partner of mine and I created called Rapid Success Technologies. And we use elements of all kinds of personal growth methodologies and systems and some proprietary patterns that we've put together. We've created a 3-day event that we just kicked off last year. So there's a variety of events. So I really kind of blend the both. I blend the both. In every one of my programs, there is an element of personal growth or personal exploration or personal performance enhancement, as well as business growth.
Well, that's important. I think personal a lot of business guys, they want to know all about how to make more money, but they forget about the personal development side, and I think that's a very big, you know, a big important key to the process. So we can definitely appreciate what you do.
So would it be fair to say, would it be fair to say then that your business is not so much aimed at small businesses, but more at small business owners?
Yeah, that's a great distinction, Bob, and I appreciate you bringing that up. I mean, I've never found a business that can operate without people, and I've never found a business that you can get to do anything without a person leading, guiding, directing, or taking action in the business. So, absolutely, it's a great distinction.
That's great.
Well, I'd like to thank you again, Spike, for your time. I know you're busy and you're running around all the time, and we worked really hard to get this together, and we had a couple false starts, so I appreciate us getting together today. I'd like to tell everybody out there, if you're listening to this and you're not on the Networking Fools site, where we're going to definitely have all the links and pictures and some other information for you there, that you need to go over to www.networkingfools.com and look up Spike Humor's page, and you'll find all that information there. And you'll also find other great interviews on all kinds of different subjects. So enjoy yourself. This is J.W. Najarian and Bob Schechter from the Networking Fools. We'd like to thank Spike Humor again. He's been just incredible and given us a bunch of great information on business turnaround and personal development and all the great things he's doing. And we'd like to thank all our listeners for their participation. And we'd like to say have a great day, a great week, a great year, and we'll see you later.
Thank you,
everyone.
Thanks,
Mike.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Networking Fools Show, featured on the Networking Fools website at www.networkingfools.com. Networking Fools is the property of Fools Media Group. Networking Fools, Networking Fool, Network Fool are all trademarks of Fools Media Group, LLC. And this audio is copyright 2010, and all rights are reserved.